Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI meets the visually impaired and encourages them to live diversity in a positive way. We celebrate World Water Day with a reminder that one in five people on this planet does not have access to fresh water. And Father Jim Brand reflects on the beauty of the universe and on the needlessness of pettiness. I've already mentioned the chock-a-block schedule the Pope is busy with practically every day. Scouring the past week's events, one in particular caught my eye because it deals with an issue that is close to my heart. On Saturday, March the 17th, I read, Pope Benedict XVI received a group of visually impaired people belonging to the Apostolic Movement for the Blind. The Pope described them as bearers of their own special experience, that of walking together side by side, the sightless and the sighted. This, he said, is a testimony of how Christian love enables handicaps to be overcome and of how to live diversity in a positive way as an opportunity to open up to others, attentive to their problems, but above all, to their gifts. You may be wondering why I describe the visually impaired as close to my heart. It's because some years ago I found myself in close contact with a group of them, when I decided to dedicate a series of radio programs to people with disabilities. I'll never forget the courage of Mary Lou, who made her way across the city, catching buses and defying the traffic with a white cane, to come and speak to me about her passion for scuba diving. That was also when I met Giulio Nardone, the president for the Italian Association for the Visually Impaired, who told me what is the biggest wrong society does to the blind.
The worst, I think, is the misunderstanding the problems and the non-understanding of the possibility that we have. So most of the, we say, normal people believe that the blind person can do only few activities, and also in the working field they believe that we can do only very, very traditional professions. Also the law in Italy helps to have these wrong ideas, because we have some laws that protect the blind people, pushing them to choose some particular professions, like telephone operators or physiotherapists. And so most blind people is working in these fields. And I know a lot of friends, a lot of members of my association that are doctor in law, perhaps, and they work like telephone operators.
Giulio says that the visually impaired not only engage in a daily battle against architectural barriers, computer programs based on user-friendly images, icons, and other visual aids, and hundreds of everyday appliances designed for people with good eyesight. They also have to fight a common negative mentality that relegates them to certain roles and protected lifestyles, marginalizing them from life. That's why, Giulio says, every year he takes about 120 blind people skiing in the Alps.
It responds to another wave of considering the blind people situation in our association, in our community. We believe that blind person has to try to do everything that is possible to do. And this is not only a system or life of living, but a way of thinking. I mean, if you are blind and you are thinking of all the things that you cannot do because you are blind, that is a wrong system to live. It's a wrong system to face the life. The right way is to consider all the things that, even though you are blind, you can do.
And that's exactly what Angela McManus is involved in promoting at Liverpool's St Vincent School for the Blind.
Our policy here is tolerance and respect across the whole community and hopefully across society. And therefore, we think a right of access to everyone. So we have a little phrase. We say there isn't any such thing as can't here. And our whole reason to be is to enable. And so we think everyone can be enabled to achieve the highest possible of their potential. And so we make sure that everyone has that right of access, and whether that's done through the different materials, resources, the way things are delivered. But we think everyone has an entitlement, and you know, whatever topic, whatever subject, we don't exclude any child from trying to access everything.
Yes, because the school welcomes children as young as 2 or 3, whose first task is to learn to get around and maybe to pick up a dropped toy.
We have mobility teachers. Everyone is trained in order to be able to guide and to enable people to find their way round. So they have a formal mobility lesson. Mobility and independence and mobility and orientation is really paramount, because if you can't get yourself to class, you're never going to access things. If you can't find your way to the washrooms and your dining hall. So as the children arrive into school, they're shown, you know, the route from the door to their cloakroom, from the cloakroom to their classroom. We have tactile markers around the school. We have different set floor surfaces. And so as the children change direction within the school building, then they know from the sound of the floor surface or the tiles on the wall or the different surfaces and markers where they are in the building. So you have to build up mental maps, mental mapping of where you are. And that takes an awful lot of memory and an awful lot of repetition, because it depends how you can access your environment. The children learn to track and to find things. Tracking is like a kind of our equivalent of eye scanning, but they scan with their hands, with their fingers, and we have they guide their own space by holding the hand a certain way to the side and in front of them as they're learning to find their way around. And you begin that within the home environment. As the toddlers, you know, the frustration as they drop a toy, well, how do they find it? So you start with what we call search to find skills. You work out from your body and you scan across in an arc in front of you to be able to find your toy on the floor.
What the teachers at the school ultimately try to do is build up the confidence and the self-esteem so that every young person may reach a level of independence.
And the ultimate goal is that our young people work within the home, within the school environment, finding their way, being as independent as possible, looking after themselves, learning to wash, to iron that, on their independence, to find the way to the bus stop, to find the way to the supermarket, to buy their own goods, to bring it back to school or to the home, cook a meal, invite friends, and just be like any other young person.
Of course, that's what we all want, isn't it? Just to be like everyone else. And even although it entails a whole lot more of hard work, a visually impaired person can live a perfectly fulfilling and exciting life.
It's just making life's experiences as practical and as hands-on, because, you know, it's finding the way. It's a different route of access, but hopefully the goals are the same, that independence and that confidence and self-esteem to go on to thrive, not just survive. And that's the goal that we have for all our young people.
So it's far from thinking that to be blind is also to be helpless. Stephen Poole, a rehabilitation officer at Liverpool's Christopher Grange Institute, is convinced of it.
Absolutely. We believe totally the opposite, in fact. We believe that it's society that disables visually impaired people. I mean, for instance, if someone with sight loss goes to a restaurant and they don't have a menu in an accessible format. Is that the fault of the person, or is it the fault of the restaurant? Well, we believe it's the fault of the restaurant. So we encourage people to be proactive with their disability.
Did you know that one in five people in the world today does not have access to fresh drinking water? That's why World Water Day, celebrated throughout the globe on March the 22nd, is in fact an important time to raise awareness and highlight the need for increased cooperation to ensure sustainable, efficient, and equitable management of scarce water resources. And the theme chosen for 2007 is in fact coping with water scarcity. Because according to the United Nations, by the year 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will live in countries affected by water scarcity. The World Water Day ceremony, hosted by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization here in Rome, saw the participation of Monsignor Renato Volante, the Vatican's permanent observer to FAO, who brought a message from Pope Benedict XVI.
Access to water is an inalienable right of all human beings. It's the basic condition to ensure the right to life, to food, to health. This is why water must not be treated as mere merchandise, and its use must be rational and fair.
I spoke to Jean-Marc Forez, Senior Water Resource Management Officer at FAO, about the event, but more especially about the problem.
Year after year, we celebrate World Water Day. I get the feeling that this year it's particularly poignant, what with all the alarm bells that have been going off regarding the course of climate change.
Well, climate change certainly adds burden to our water problem. We have several challenges in terms of water. We have to bring water to people everywhere. We have to cope with what we see as increasing scarcity of water everywhere because people are using more water. And climate change, yes, indeed, in many parts of the world can worsen the problem.
Now, in fact, as you were mentioning, the theme highlighted this year is coping with water scarcity. But it has been quite a few years that a UN report claimed that mankind's most serious challenge in the 21st century could be the lack of fresh water. How true is that proving?
Well, this is really our concern, and that's why we want to ring the alarm bell, because the water resources, they are renewable resources. Through rain, we receive water every year, but they are a finite resource because we don't receive an infinite amount of water. And those resources are being stretched because we need more water to drink, we need more water to produce food, we need more water for industrial production, etc. And as the population increase and development increases, the pressure on water resources increase also.
What are the main contributors to water scarcity?
Well, certainly agriculture plays a very important role because we considered that 70% of all freshwater use in the world on average comes from irrigated agriculture. And this is a major challenge for us at FAO, but for the whole world, because we all need food. And we know we'll have another 2 billion people coming in the forthcoming decades on the planet. So we really have to make sure that we promote an agriculture that is always more productive. In a few words, that we produce more with less water.
Is it the usual story that in the rich nations we use a lot of water and in the developing countries there's just not enough water to go around?
Questions of poverty are certainly very much linked to water scarcity, and you can just think of children in rural areas of poor countries having to carry water for kilometers to bring the little bit of water they need for their daily consumption. Therefore, there is a very strong linkage between poverty and problems of water scarcity at household level. Now, in terms of global figures, I would say water use is more dictated by climate, and it's in the arid and semi-arid areas that we have most need of water, in particular in agriculture, where rainfall is not sufficient to satisfy plants water needs.
Is it in these areas that billions of people already do lack access to clean water?
Yes, I would like to make a distinction between access to the water you need for daily purposes, drinking water, domestic water, which is not so much in volume, but it's very important for life and livelihood. And that's really a question of infrastructure or investment of policies at national levels to really make sure that everybody has access to clean water. And then there is this problem of scarcity, or what we call physical scarcity, where water is not enough anymore in the country, in the region, in the river basin to satisfy all the needs. So you have what we call physical, and sometimes we call it economic water scarcity.
Do you have any idea of the scale of the problem? I mean, how many people are there, in fact, in the world who do not have access to water?
Access to water for domestic purposes, yeah. It's estimated at something above 1 billion people. Now, another major issue also is access to sanitation. You know how important sanitation is. And here we have more than 2 billion people who don't have access to satisfactory sanitation. This is really a very big percentage of the world's population.
Which, of course, leads to a whole lot of health problems, for
Extremely
example.
Extremely linked to health problems. We have shown a very strong linkage with diseases, and especially with children.
Now, in developed countries, water is largely taken for granted, isn't it? How important is it to raise awareness that this problem is a serious one?
Yes, it is taken for granted, and it has been taken for granted all over the world as water was plentiful. And now what we are seeing everywhere is that people start to understand the value of water, and I'm sure in most cities, even in developed countries, the water bill is increasing, and it's increasing in part because we take more care of the problem of treatment. You cannot just throw back your dirty water in the river anymore. You need to treat it, and it costs. It costs it to bring it to your tap, and it costs it to treat it after you have used it. And that definitely is being seen all over the world in rich and poor countries. We have to understand better that there is also a strong linkage with the environment.
The World Water Day ceremony is all very well, but does FAO have projects on the ground or projects it intends to implement to tackle the problem?
Yes, I would say first the ceremony in Rome is really the top of the iceberg, if I can say so. World Water Day is first a day to be celebrated everywhere, in every country, in schools, institutions, etc. And indeed, that's what is happening now. In FAO this year, we are the coordinator for the UN system of World Water Day, and therefore we have our own ceremony here. But as you said, ceremony is very good, but what's important is work on the ground. So this day is a day to raise awareness a little bit more than the other days of the year, but we have all year round projects on the ground at all levels, I would say. At level of the farmer, we need to give farmers the capacity, as I said, to grow food with less water, but to have also the water they need to sustain their livelihood. At country level, at national level, there is a whole issue of integrated water management, making sure that water allocation is for the benefit of the society as a whole, and there is a lot of work we do with the countries also in there. And then, of course, there are at international level, I think also of international river, countries sharing the same water, they need to talk together, they need to negotiate, and they need to make sure that they use this common resource in the most beneficial way.
Make it become an avenue of collaboration.
It is, indeed. And if you look at all the treaties you have on water around the world, mm-hmm. you can say that water scarcity leads more to collaboration than to war, as people sometimes say.
Has the Vatican, to your knowledge, been showing interest and participation in environment lately? And do you think it can make a difference?
We think that for such an important subject as water, where everybody is concerned, all the moral authorities have a role to play. And we see this in the case of Vatican, which join us in celebrating this day. We think it's very important that at all level we receive message that this issue is very important and requires everybody's action.
Mr. Faure, finally, do you have a message for our listeners on this World Day of Water?
Yes, the message is so complicated, but it can boil down to something very simple. We all live on the same planet with the same limited resources, and it's our common duty to make sure that we manage those resources in a way that is sustainable and that future generations can enjoy the same way we have enjoyed so far.
And now Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director of the Pontifical Beda College, takes us into the magnificent countryside of the English poet D.H. Lawrence with a delightful meditation on how important it is not to be petty.
Hello, it's Father Jim. As we're getting near Easter, and Lent is a time of prayer and purification, I'm just thinking about those sort of things that just spoil us. On the whole, we're good. But we can only become better if we admit we're good. You can't jump from being bad straight to being better. Because the word better is the comparative of the word good. We have to admit we're good first, and then we'll become better. And this was brought home to me when I went to one or two master classes. I was learning some piano concertos. And I remember I was going to play Beethoven's Emperor Piano Concerto, and I banged my fists down on the keyboard for the opening chord, and my teacher stopped me. Stop! He said, I can't hear the third note in the left hand. Try again. So I tried again. Stop. Well, I was getting frustrated. He kept stopping me. And eventually he laughed. He said, look, Jim, you want to give me a concert, don't you? You'd like to play the whole piano concerto to give me such joy. I said, I'd love to. He said, in which case, I should be paying you. But you're paying me to take you from one level to another. And as we advance in perfection, the next stage gets more and more painful. For instance, people need masterclasses in the spiritual life. This doesn't mean the person giving the class is necessarily ahead of anyone else. I remember enjoying enormously Torval and Dean, the great ice dancing champions. They had an enchanting teacher. Now, maybe she wasn't as good a skater as they were, otherwise she would have been as famous. But she could still take them from one level to another. And so what I'm suggesting is that we're good, but occasionally something spoils it. You know, some little beastliness. And this poem called Snake by David Herbert Lawrence, D.H. Lawrence, has taught me a little bit about those little things that just spoil us. And perhaps we could have a little think in a few remaining days of Lent about those little things that just spoil the goodness God has placed in us. It's called Snake. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I in pajamas for the heat to drink there. In the deep, strange, scented shade of the great dark carob tree, I came down the steps with my pitcher, and I must wait. Must stand and wait, for there he was at the water trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom and trailed his yellow-brown slackness soft-bellied down over the edge of the stone trough and rested his throat upon the stone bottom. And where the water dripped from the tap in a small clearness, he sipped with his straight mouth, softly drank through his straight gums into his slack, long body, silently. Someone was before me in my water trough, and I, like a second comer, waiting. He lifted his head from his drinking as cattle do. He looked at me vaguely as drinking cattle do, and flickered his two-forked tongue from his lips and mused a moment, stooped and drank a little more. Being earth brown, earth golden, from the burning bowels of the earth on the day of Sicilian July, with Etna smoking. The voice of my education said to me he must be killed, for in Sicily the black snakes are innocent, the gold are venomous. And voices in me said if you were a man, you'd take a stick and break him down and finish him off. But must I confess how I liked him? How glad I was he'd come like a guest in quiet to drink at my water trough and depart peaceful, pacified and thankless into the burning bowels of the earth. Was it cowardice? I dared not kill him. Was it perversity that I longed to talk to him? Was it humility to feel so honoured? I felt so honoured. Yet those voices, if you were not afraid you'd kill him. Truly I was afraid. I was most afraid. But even so, honoured still more that he should seek my hospitality from out the dark door of the secret earth. He drank enough, and lifted his head dreamily as one who's drunken, and flickered his tongue like a forked knight in the air, so black, seeming to lick his lips, and looked round like a god unseeing into the air, and slowly turned his head, and slowly, very slowly, as if thrice a dream, proceeded to draw his slow length, curving round, and climb again the broken bank of my wall face. And as he put his head into that dreadful hole, and as he slowly drew up, snake-easing his shoulders and entered further, a sort of horror, a sort of protest against his withdrawing into that horrid black hole, deliberately going into the blackness and slowly drawing himself after, overcame me. Now his back was turned. I looked round, put down my pitcher, I picked up a clumsy log and threw it at the water trough with a clatter. I think it didn't hit him, but suddenly that part of him that was left behind convulsed in undignified haste, wreathed like lightning, and was gone into the black hole, the earth-lipped fissure in the wall front, to which in the intense still noon I stared with fascination. And immediately I regretted it. I thought how paltry, how vulgar, what a mean act. I despised myself and the voices of my accursed human education. And I thought of the albatross. And I wish he'd come back, my snake. For he seemed to me again like a king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld, now due to be crowned again. And so, I missed my chance with one of the lords of life. And I have something to expiate. A pettiness. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.